Welcome to Things I Wish I Knew, the podcast from Thinking Faith, a work of the Jesuits in Britain. I'm Julia, I'm in my early 30s and I used to live in a Jesuit young adult community. We all live hectic lives and often don't get time to reflect on what's happening both to us and around us. This podcast is meant to help you to take a moment to stop and think about where you are, where you're going, and where your relationship with God fits into it all. Every week I meet a new guest who tells me about something they experienced which changed their life forever. By talking about the things they wish they'd known, we'll explore the idea that God is in all things. And we'll talk about the part that faith plays in navigating life's challenges. Today I'm speaking to Christine, the director of CAFOD, which is the Catholic Agency for Overseas Development. I love talking to Christine about her journey to being director of CAFOD, but also about how she stays herself. So Christine, did you always have an involvement in church?
I think like most people, it has had on and off. I mean, I think in my teenage years, I was definitely kind of quite rebellious. I was born into a regular cradle Catholic family, although my mum was, she had to become a Catholic in order to marry my dad. So she kind of quite liked to remind us that she was a convert. And she was much more active to some extent in church, but in a very, very ordinary sort of way. I mean, she would help people do food for neighbours. We had an elderly neighbour that came in for his tea three times a week for what felt like centuries, you know. So it was a very ordinary kind of church upbringing. I think when I was a teenager, I was like, what's all this about? My dad had lost his job. There was all sorts of kind of, you know, you go through those stages where you wonder what's going on in life and sort of rebelled a bit. And then I had this friend in school that said, well, we have this group called Young Christian Students and we meet in the boys' school over the road. So it was like, okay, great, you know. so that kind of was less, it wasn't a prayer group or anything like that. It was a kind of discussion group. YCS uses the See, Judge, Act methodology. So there was an element of kind of like reflecting, but it wasn't overtly sort of, you know, the Holy Joes as you talk about it. But that got me into kind of deepening my faith a bit more. When I was a student, I never really kind of got involved in like chaplaincy stuff. So I've always been, I felt, my faith is kind of strong, but hasn't necessarily always been articulated in a church capacity. I have been lucky, though, that in for a lot of my adult life, I've been in parishes where I felt really nourished and encouraged.
So what did joining the Young Christian Students teach you about faith and leadership?
It taught me quite a lot about faith being active, that you're part of history, you're part of something bigger. You're meeting people from other YCS groups and even at some point going on like an international conference and sort of like, oh, there's a whole world here. That was really interesting. Leadership, it wasn't an explicit sense of leadership training, but I kind of think back to the things that I did. We would organise retreats or conferences, you know, trips, as well as the sort of like the weekly meetings and stuff. So, you know, after a few years, then taking a role in leadership and thinking, I think back now and I think, well, yeah, that's where my kind of organisational skills and capacity sort of like was honed from an extraordinarily early age. Yeah.
I was thinking about how at university was kind of being a cradle Catholic myself, I kind of had that experience of church was what we did. We went to church on a Sunday. And it was only at university that I kind of started to actively choose my own faith, in that I had the choice to whether I was going to do something else on a Sunday or go to church or not. Did you have a similar experience?
Yeah, I think most people do, don't they? I think, you know, when you stop being taken, it's a bit like the dentists, you know, when you stop being taken, you have to kind of make a decision to put yourself through it. And I did once go for 16 years between dental appointments, but that's an aside. I think there is that sense in which you kind of think, yeah, I'm making a conscious decision about this. I think it also does depend about what the nature of the options are. I've been in places where, frankly, there's no point going to that place. It gives me a theological crisis, you know, and then other churches and other situations have been really great and really deep and meaningful and nurturing.
So you studied philosophy and international relations. How did you end up studying that?
Oh, totally accidentally. I was working for the Young Christian Students for a year with my friend Sarah Bull, who is the other worker, and she was doing it as a gap year before going off to uni to study. She was clear what she wanted to do. I had no idea. And there was one day where she said to me, like, you know, I'm the one that's going off to uni, but you're the one that's reading all the kind of like the detail, you know, the Marxist books and the political analysis. You know, why don't you go off to uni? I was like, I never thought about it before. So she encouraged me and helped me think about it. And North Staffs Poly was offering this degree where you could do different choices. So it was politics, philosophy, economics, international relations. I had no idea kind of what they were, but I thought I wanted to do something kind of vaguely political because I wanted to change the world, don't we all? And the philosophy side really attracted me because it was just going that bit deeper. It was kind of, it wasn't just about political machinations. It was actually about, well, where do policies come from? Where do perspectives come from? How do you see the world rooted in the kind of, you know, philosophical kind of analysis, really? And and I guess that was possibly as near to sort of ethics as I could possibly as I could get to. It was fascinating. I really loved it.
So how did you go from that to then end up the Justice and Peace Coordinator in Liverpool?
Well, I went back home, finished uni. I mean, I was very lucky in those days. I'd had a grant, so I wasn't like absolutely up to my eyeballs in debt, but I didn't have any money and I went home and looked around for some jobs. I did some like temping work, some secretarial work, and I just saw this job advertised in the paper of kind of like an assistant, and I went along, and they said, you know, I was massively overqualified as someone with a degree, but I was like, well, I've never really, you know, had a proper job. I've always kind of like worked in various things, but in an office situation. Anyway, they took a punt on me, and the rest is history. And the guy I worked with, Liam Black, who was the main Justice and Peace officer, I was just the assistant. So in theory, I was the one that did the newsletter and kind of like sorted everything out and the accounts. But he encouraged me to also get involved in stuff. So I was doing like welfare rights training and doing some community development work and drawing on my experience with the YCS and getting to know communities and working with them. And you know, I admire him hugely because he, again, was someone who saw my potential and helped me grow. He wasn't someone who was so, anxious that he'd keep this woman kind of like aside. But it was a real partnership, yeah.
So how did you get from Justice and Peace Assistant to Director of CAFOD?
Well, so I'd been Liverpool JMP for a couple of years, and one of the things that I had to do was organise the National Justice and Peace Conference, Liverpool, 1988. And that gives my age away. Oh, no. Anyway, in 1988, back in the days when we had phones with circular things and cables and typewriters. Anyway, I was part of organising the National Justice and Peace Conference that was held in Liverpool. And through that, I got to meet Mildred Neville, Ed O'Connell, the whole kind of like National Justice and Peace kind of groups, and amazing people. Margaret Walsh from the Hope Community. So that helped sort of like connect me with people. And I remember getting a phone call from Julian Filikowski when we were organising the conference saying, you've got to have a workshop on HIV in Africa, please. And I was like, oh, yeah, okay. You know, and I'd known people who had been affected by HIV here in England and I hadn't kind of like connected with the international thing at all. So I was like, oh, yeah, okay. You know, I didn't realise that was actually quite a big issue. But I was like, oh yeah, no, that's really interesting. So I suppose we just got to know people through that. Anyway, after a couple of years, Liam moved on, and I applied for the job and didn't get it. And it was a gut wrenching thing because I just kind of thought, well, you know, this is just a great environment, and I could do Liam's job, and you know. I was absolutely stunned, really. And then I found out that Ellen Teague was going off on maternity leave, and so CAFOD were looking for a maternity cover, and as a campaign coordinator. And so I came down to London and, you know, kind of bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, and had an interview with Julian, and somehow or other, they obviously confused me with someone who's competent and they gave me the job. My poor mother, I remember that coming back. I'm moving to London next week, Mum, you know. And I mean, I've got a daughter who's 20 and I kind of think, what did I put my mother through? And yet she was constantly amazing. So that was my, I got the job at CAFOD, which I did for a year and then moved on.
But it sounds like you had a plan of like you were going to go for this coordinator role and God shut that down and then opened up the next opportunity.
It was, yeah. I mean, it didn't feel like that at the time.
I don't think it ever feels like that.
No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. But I remember getting a letter from one of the members of the Justice and Peace Commission who were my boss, Celia, and she, it was like kind of four lines on a piece of paper and she just said, it feels awful now, but this is the best thing that could ever happen to you and you are amazing and never forget it and I will follow your career with interest. I mean, she's no longer with us, but I remember feeling, oh yeah. But it was, you know, it was that opportunity. I mean, it's sad for me in many respects because there's always a part of me that regrets not living in Liverpool because of where I'm from, and I've spent more of my life away from Liverpool than in Liverpool. But the opportunities it sort of made me open my eyes and it made me kind of think, well, what do I need to do? And I mean, I wouldn't say it was a plan particularly, but it was the sort of, it was like, it, I suppose it opened that closing down of that door made me kind of think, oh, okay, so what am I going to do then? You know, what, you know, I have to think a bit more widely. And I suppose I'd come from a very ordinary working class background. I never thought I didn't go to a uni, I went to a poly, but I never thought I'd get a degree. And, you know, and again, like looking back on my life now, I did more studies. I got awarded an honorary doctorate. You know, I'm director of CAFOD. I mean, it's a job, it's a life that my 16 or even 18-year-old self would just not have comprehended.
Well, saying about CAFOD, I was working for CAFOD at the time you became the director of CAFOD, and I just remember there was a lot of excitement to have a woman as a director. And I think people were always referring back to how when CAFOD was set up, it was set up by women, but then it only had men as directors. Did that put a lot of pressure on you, or did it give you a lot of excitement?
Well, it's both. I mean, yes, I think I did feel the weight of the expectations because I think there was a sense from some people who had known me before as this kind of like, you know, mouthy firebrand in the 1980s. And obviously I'd known Julian. So in some respects, I had been kind of embedded a little bit in CAFOD's history. So I kind of felt that sense of expectation from some people. And at the same time, being conscious that, but I'm here to do a job, I'm here to run an organisation, and I'm not here to be the woman on the barricades sort of thing. I mean, and yeah, it was really exciting to be the first woman, because I think as an organisation that's founded by the most amazing women, completely different class to me, it was really exciting, you know. And it's something that I tell all the time in stories about the fact that, you know, women founded it, women got it organised, they raised all the money, and then the boys said, okay, thanks, you know, we'll take it from here. 60 years later, you know, I don't want that to sound like it's men versus women, but there was, I think, a great recognition of the fact that CAFOD's as a lay-led organisation and a female-founded organisation is an important history. And because the story of women's contribution to how the world is a better place is a story that's so rarely told. And I think back right through my life, and of course there are amazing people like Oscar Romero and the Jesuits and all, you know, and Steve Biko and all sorts of people. And at the same time, the people that I've met in communities have by and large been the women, you know, whether they're in church-based situations or in ordinary secular communities. By and large, the real leaders, the real energy behind everything kind of comes from the women. And that's not to say men don't do anything, but it is about saying we actually need to tell those stories. We need to recognise the herstory, not just the history.
Mm. So for those who are listening who don't know what CAFOD is, what is CAFOD and what do you do as director?
CAFOD's the official agency of the Catholic Church here in England and Wales for development and emergency relief. And as its name suggests, we provide support to a raft of local partners to help build and strengthen the ability of those partners to make a difference in their lives, to build sustainable and lasting development. And that might be through farming, it might be through business, jobs, all sorts of different ways in which we're supporting people. And then we also do emergency relief and emergency response in times of great need, where people literally need to have their lives saved, right, through aid. And we're part of the global Caritas family, so it means we've got a wide reach. As director, you know, the buck stops with me. I suppose I'm the figurehead kind of figure, I suppose. But it's an amazing team of people who work incredibly hard to do fantastic work around the world and to raise a lot of money and also to bring about advocacy and bring about advocating change in policy and help the Catholic community here in England and Wales put their faith into practice, to deepen that faith, to deepen that sense of understanding of our responsibility and our relationship with our neighbours, and to make a difference, really. As director, I often think I spend most of my time in meetings, writing reports, assessing, you know, kind of looking at statistics and KPIs. But I also have the most incredible job, which enables me to meet with politicians, visit projects around the world, get inspired by people, try to influence, engage in support with where the church is. Be that voice of those, you know, millions of people and millions of Catholics around the world that are really concerned about making a difference.
So as the director of CAFOD, are you often involved in conversations about leadership in the church?
I'm often involved in conversations about leadership in church settings.
Yeah.
And I think there's the conversations about leadership in the church, they tend to be often kind of people's individual kind of conversations. But yeah, there's a growing concern about making sure that leadership in the church, in church settings, is respected, is growing, is much more professionalised than it was when I first started. You know, there's a real sense of, you know, the church being a professional employer, treating people well, making sure that we run things well and we do things to high standards.
Yeah, I definitely say it's not perfect, but it's definitely a better place of where you think of the old vision of like one woman being the parish secretary running the whole church, like doing all the admin in the background. Is there any frustrations for you when you hear about people talking about the conversation about women in roles in the church?
Well, I think the first one is often that the contribution of women isn't recognised. I think the other aspect for me is that when there are conversations about women and the church, women's leadership in the church, it often comes down to, can we be priests or not? And I totally respect women who feel called to that ministry and feel frustrated by it. But the contribution of women in the church and the leadership of women in the church goes way beyond priesthood. I mean, and I think I find the whole clerical culture quite frustrating. And that applies to both men and women. And I think there's quite a lot of priests who find it very frustrating as well, because they kind of feel themselves constrained in a box and kind of what do lay people kind of put on them. So clericalism isn't the preserve of the clerics. Clericalism actually, at its worst, is lay people who refuse to take their baptismal promises seriously. You know, say, oh, well, you know, Father, you know, kind of. You know. So I do find that quite frustrating at times, because I personally don't feel called to priesthood. I kind of feel that when you have conversations with people about being a leader in the church, that priesthood is the only model that often is there in the minds. And it's like, well, actually, you know, look around you. There's so much that's going on. There's so much that's being done and being delivered as the church. You know, women are still on the altars. Women are doing all sorts of things. And it's almost like that's never quite recognised. So there's an element of frustration there. But I do understand where people come from and I do appreciate it. I don't want to sound like I'm anti.
No, I think I was just thinking also, yeah, I agree about the frustration of the role of women, but I also think of it for the men who don't end up being priests, it's the same as well. For
yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So what does being a lay leader mean to you?
Well, I think it means taking your responsibility seriously. You know, I think it means stuff's got to get done. We've just got to roll up our sleeves and do it. And I guess going back to those days of YCS, of being, you know, kind of like organising lots of things, there is a sense of, well, stuff's got to get done and we're going to make it happen. But a leader, it's that phrase, isn't there? A leader without a follower is just someone going on a walk. And part of my, what I feel is my responsibility is in a leadership position is about how do I ensure, enable and contribute to other people playing their part effectively. Not everybody is a leader. Not mm-hmm. everybody, you know, it isn't a sort of linear role. I've seen quite a lot of people, frankly, promoted beyond their capabilities. But, you know, and we see it in public life all the time, people failing up, you know. Yeah. But I think it is about how do we encourage people. So I try to, either within a work environment or through my own personal time, kind of support other people, particularly women in leadership roles or early on leadership roles. And, you know, it's not like I'm not a formally trained coach or anything like that, but it's more like, well, let's have a cup of tea and let's have a bit of encouragement and, you know, have a chat. And, you know, some of this isn't rocket science, and some of this needs you to really pull on a lot of inner strength. Leadership is also often a really unpopular place to be, because you have to take that responsibility and you have to make difficult decisions, and you're not necessarily going to be liked. You know, I am an inveterate people pleaser, and it's sometimes that's the hardest part of it. You know, having negative things said about me or you know, kind of all that kind of stuff. And I just think, yeah, but I've got difficult decisions I've got to make. We're not having to cut staff because I've woken up one morning rubbing my hands with glee to say, who can I make cry today? It's actually, I've got a really difficult decision about the sustainability of the organisation in 3-5 years' time. It's, you know, it's difficult. And equally, just in a parish setting, you know, leadership is or in an everyday life setting, leadership is kind of putting your head above the parapet and saying, actually, how can I take responsibility for something here? That takes real courage. And yeah, it takes real courage sometimes not being liked. But then, you know, you kind of look at it, we're Christians, aren't we? Ultimately, the essence of leadership is there in Jesus on the cross, you know, paying the ultimate price, failing miserably in the eyes of all of his all of his supporters and followers who had run off, who had completely disappeared. You know, who's at the foot of the cross? His mum, and obviously the disciple that loved him. All of, you know, but it was the women at the foot of the cross. And I kind of think, you know, there's a whole load there about, that sounds terrible, doesn't it? Sounds terribly arrogant. Oh, you know, but we do carry crosses. And I think leadership, being responsible, taking your responsibility seriously, is a cross to carry.
So as a leader, how do you discern those bigger, tougher decisions?
Well, you rarely do them on your own. A lot of like the literature kind of ways of thinking about leaders is very often, you know, it's a male out there and, you know, carrying everything on their own. It's the Alan Sugar, you know, I'm individually making decisions. The reality is that, you're leading an organisation, which is often, you know, groups of people. So the team that I work with have to work well together, have to help one another and help us all make good decisions. If it was just about what I decided on its own, God help CAFOD. You know, there is that side of it. So it's about getting the best out of people. It's about making sure that we're able to make decisions. Yeah, my job is to make sure we make them, not just to sit around and talk forever, but we make them well informed with a sense of, And to help us all kind of identify that vision and take that responsibility seriously of how do we meet that vision. But yeah, there is the sense in which the buck stops here, the decisions are on my shoulders. I am very conscious of that. You share the glory, you take the pain.
You said God help CAFOD. But I assume God does help those decisions as well.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, just any form of thinking through decisions and discernment is absolutely rooted in that quiet, prayerful plea that we make to help me make these decisions well.
So are you ever just Christine and not the Christine, the director of CAFOD? Do you ever get that time to just be yourself?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's why in my parish, I'm Christine that helps with the music. I'm not Christine the director of CAFOD. It is very important. And I'm a mum and a terrible wife. I absolutely couldn't do it without my husband. I mean, he's just amazing in terms of making sure things happen. I'd never be fed otherwise, you know, it's just mad. So yeah, there's a lot of that that's me. And a lot of it is rooted in, yes, in just in that kind of quiet time sometimes.
So what does Christine, who does the music, mean?
I mean, I'm probably a complete pain in the arse to them, but I help coordinate the music in my church. And so we have a number of different sort of things. I run a kids choir, which is very exciting. More like, actually, they I was going to say more like crowd control than music, but actually they're amazing. I mean, in the practice, there's that bit where you think, oh God, what's going to happen? And then they just deliver the most beautiful sounds. It's just lovely. And yeah, I play the piano and stuff like that. So music, I really enjoy music in church settings, but I'm an interesting mix of, I do like quite contemporary music, which I know a lot of people hate, but I really like contemporary music because I do find that the being able to express one's emotions in a holy setting is incredibly powerful. And it certainly helps me tap into it in a way that in other parts of my life, I don't always operate out of that emotional space.
So how do you stay authentically yourself? And by that, I mean that you don't become this persona that is Christine, director of CAFODs. How do you stay true to yourself?
Well, I think prayer is an important part of that, and a recognition of some level of humility. I mean, God does often kind of do those things, that, you know, you're coming home from an event, say, it's been amazing, and you've had all the sort of adulation, and you know, then someone's going to kind of give you a hard time on the tube or something like that. Do you know what I mean? It's just those things always kind of tend to happen. So there's prayer, there's quiet time, there's being me, there's being open to not being up myself. My family situation is very much not CAFOD and adulation, so I'm just quite ordinary. In that respect.
So what do you wish you knew about leadership and faith when you started this journey?
I mean, yeah, thinking back to the beginning of my sort of career, if you like, I guess there's something about recognising how connected sort of leadership and faith are for me, that it is, that faith has always been, as I said, faith has always been just sort of like there. It's not necessarily been the thing about going into church, or there's a sort of inner core to it. And so I guess that sense of kind of like leadership and faith is like how faith sustains all aspects of one's life. And from a faith perspective, I think leadership means something very different than, you know, kind of business manuals might tell you. But that's taken quite a long time to learn what that means, because that's been quite countercultural throughout a lot of my life. I think we're in a different place now in terms of leadership. You know, I look at kind of TED Talks and I hear, you know, we talk about vulnerability and we talk about servant leadership and all that kind of stuff. Well, that was like woo-woo stuff when I was first starting out career-wise. You know, that people would think you were bonkers if you talked about that in that way. And then I think the other thing is that I'm doing okay. When I was young, I did the 11 plus, didn't actually know I was doing it, I just did this test, and I passed the 11 plus. I got into the grammar school only for a year, and then was made comprehensive. But I remember my mum telling her sister that I'd got into school, and my Auntie Mary was quite she found it very difficult to praise people, mind you, maybe. So she'd go, oh, get you, state of you. You won't be wanting to talk to the likes of us anymore. And there's always been that sort of sense of don't get above your station. Don't, you know, don't step into those places. So I've often struggled with what does it mean to be a leader? You know, who wants to listen to me? So if I'm playing a role as CAFOD director, I'm speaking on behalf of CAFOD, there's no stopping me. But as me, there's that fundamental insecurity and sort of terror about what am I worthy of, you know? And faith has been an important part in helping me to understand my worth, because God loves me. End of story. It doesn't matter. You know, I'm not perfect. Nobody is. But that fundamental love is there. And that's taken a long time to kind of come to terms with, come to grips with, and embody that in a leadership message.
I was just thinking about how I think God often uses our moments of weakness, and I use that very like loosely, so that you're not feeling like you can't get above your station. I think God uses that in a way to like push us further than we would if we were feeling great. I'm born to be a leader.
Well, I always do think that, you know, the worst leaders are the ones who think they're the best, because you've always got to have that sense of, well, who am I? What am I about? And getting that balance between your strengths and your weaknesses is always difficult, because you don't want to be beating yourself up all the time. You don't want to be kind of like flagellating yourself of, oh, I'm not worthy, you know, because that's just irritating as well. But it's a middle line between just being authentic, you know, recognising, yeah, I'm good, you know. And I use this brilliant quote of, you know, what really frightens you is not your weakness, it's your strength. You know, the Marianne Taylor Williams quote, which is amazing. And, you know, right in the middle, it says, because you are a child of God, you know, and that's what's so powerful about it. And I think that's the thing, is we often, and I think it's a gender thing too, you know, women, not that men don't, but I think women often feel it much more themselves, that I don't want my light to shine, you know, or that it's somehow not right to be strong and confident in yourself. But as long as there's an authenticity there, then I think that's what matters.
So what are you most grateful for?
I suppose I'm grateful for the huge number of people that have helped me be the person I am, and the way in which I've been able to kind of grow and take opportunities and been seen to have opportunities throughout my life, from my parents, you know, like I was saying before, what I put my mother through in my life, I've no idea. And there's moments when I kind of think, oh yeah, I know she's looking down on me, like kind of giving me a kick in a nice way. You know, lots of people have kind of opened doors for me, or enabled me to see doors that were open, and encouraged me and seen things in me that I had not seen. I am fundamentally grateful for the sort of church tradition and scripture and all of that, that kind of helps me have a clear sense of what's right and what's wrong in the world, and that powers me along, knowing that I'm walking alongside so many other people. But ultimately, the people that I'm most grateful to, my husband and my daughter, because fundamentally, I wouldn't be able to do what I do without my husband, and I'm so proud of my daughter who's going to carry it on. She's studying civil engineering. She said to me, well, someone's got to solve the problems of this world that your generation have left us with, you know. And I, you know, my heart broke because it was like, I've done my best, Grace, you know. It's like, you know, but actually it's brilliant, because it's kind of like that sense of she's got confidence in herself and what she can do. And I'm like, yes, you know, she's all the things that I kind of wanted to be.
Thanks for listening to Things I Wish I Knew. I know this episode is going to stay with me because Christine talked about the importance of being grounded in her own identity, and it was a gentle reminder for us all to be authentic to who God is calling us to be. How about you? We'd love to hear how Christine's story resonated with you. And why not also tell us if you're facing an experience you wish you knew how to look at differently? It might just be something we can help with. You can find out more about this and other themes at thinkingfaith.org. Thank you again for listening. I hope you'll join me again next time on Things I Wish I Knew.